Someone recently posted a comment on the website to inform me and whoever else might be reading the website that tree squirrels do not hibernate, which is a quite peculiar fact, especially as it doesn't seem to have anything to do with anything else I might have posted or read, although I could be mistaken, I don't have a very good memory. But I wanted to let that listener know that no, you're perfectly correct, tree squirrels do not hibernate. However, when the weather is very cold, they will often stay in their nest and not eat for several days at a time. They won't even go out for anything. Which is quite like me, as a matter of fact. And so I invite all of you to come to the website and let me know how you are most like a tree squirrel. Good evening. It's Friday, the 8th of December, 2006, and it's Miette's Bedtime Story Podcast. A Letter to A.A. Almost Anybody by Charles Wilford. Dear Sir, or maybe you're a lady, or a disparate group, I don't know. I am an alcoholic, or should that be capitalized? All right, I make you the gift of the capital. I am an alcoholic, and I need your help. At least I think I do. I'm not sure. I'm not sure of anything anymore except that I am an alcoholic, and a sober one at that. And if there is anything more disgusting than a sober alcoholic, I don't know what it is. Being sober all the time has me befuddled and confused, although, up to now, I was under the impression that being sober was supposed to be an ideal, or at least idealistic, state for an alcoholic. I know I feel better, even though I feel worse, and if you can make good sense out of that, then you are a better man, or a woman, or an alcoholic, than I am. Talk it out, George! That's the only way to get at the root of the thing. That's what Fred... He's the chairman at our local AA chapter, and that's what Fred... I never asked him what his last name was, although I know what it is, and he never asked for mine, although he knew it, but you know the rules about last names as well as I do, and all I'm trying to do now is follow Fred's advice, as he said I ought to do. Talk it out, George. Down to it. Get down to it. I keep trying to delay, to put it off, to sneak around and avoid the over, under, or through... I even went back and read my last paragraph. Like Falconer, man. Sir, I mean. And now I know how he wrote all of those compounded and involved syntaxes. He was sober. He had to be. But I'll start. And if the beginning doesn't make me reach for that brown, unopened bottle in front of me, nothing else will. Or so I think, but really don't know. I do know, or think I know, that by the time I finish this letter, or scream, if I can finish it, and if you get it, which you will, I suppose, if I mail it, and I'll mail it if I can find a stamp around the house someplace, and if you do get it, which you will if it is delivered, my problem will be solved long before then. Mr. Anthony, I have a problem. Whatever became of Mr. Anthony, anyway? All right, the beginning. If I don't weep, and maybe this time I won't, isn't it possible that the time will come when the beginning will no longer make a man cry? Don't the tears ever dry up and go away somewhere? Like, how many times does a man have to pay for it? I mean, the beginning, and I was drunk even then, although I wasn't then a drunk, an alcoholic. I became a drunk, an alcoholic, because I was drunk at the time. And because I was drunk at the time, that's how it happened. Although I wasn't an alcoholic at the time, I was only drunk. Which isn't the same, you know. My wife's arm... several minutes have gone by. 15 of them, maybe. I smoked a cigarette, taking my time. I didn't open the bottle, and I didn't weep. A milestone. This is the first time for this test, the written test, and I was able to think about it without trying to drown it, or pickle it is a better term, although drinking never really worked anyway. My wife's arm. There. It was much easier to write the second time. Arm, 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 arm. Nothing. None. Maybe I'm finished inside. All gone. Empty. Voided, like my wife's arm. It is gone. And I did it. And I'm an alcoholic. A sober alcoholic right now, but I was one of the drunkest alcoholics anybody ever saw around this town for the last 4 years. And even though this is a small city, there have been some mighty fine drunks residing here, including my friend Fred, before he sobered up and then did the same for me. I drank with the best of them, boy. I mean, sir. Madam? Although, later on, I preferred to drink alone. That is, around the house where I could see her. Because she never touched a drop after my wife and her arm, or where the arm used to be. It sort of kept the evil spirits up. No double entendre intended. I'm not trying to be funny, for God's sake. I'm trying to get down to it. The accident. And my wife's arm. And how can I tell about it without sounding like a lugubrious, fatuous ass? Although, if I hadn't been drunk at the time, I said this, there wouldn't have been any accident, and my wife would still have her arm. Her left arm. That's the arm that was sheared off at the shoulder, as the newspaper reported it. Sheared off. The car door did it. But I really did it, because I was drunk at the time and driving home from the country club dance recklessly. The same old monotonous Saturday night dance that is held every Saturday night during the summer, outside on the patio when the weather is nice with Japanese lanterns, and inside when it rains, and maybe the dances are still being held. I never went back to the club again, not after the accident. I was too afraid that somebody would commiserate with me, or worse, pretend to talk about something else when they were really thinking about my wife's lost arm and me drunk and smashing up the car. And I didn't even get a scratch. Not a scratch. I was lucky, my mother told me, even as she was bawling. And dead now. She died, mother, 8 months after the accident, the old liver trouble she had had for years, poor sweet soul. But in that dismal, horrible, grey Sunday dawn at the hospital. And I was sober then, all right, hanging around the first in the hall, and then in the waiting room and back to the hall, unable to sit down, not even for a second. The beard stubble on my face making me feel dirty, and the damned cigarette machine in the corridor only took a quarter and a nickel, not 3 dimes, and nobody had any change, of course. And my mother picked this time to say, crying, "You were lucky, George." Lucky! The strangled scream hurt my throat, and then the doctor came, and I was crying wildly and carrying on, hitting the innocent white walls with my fists. And he gave me a shot that didn't work, and he told me to go home. Not me. I went to the White Springs Hotel instead, and bought 2/5 of old Grandpappy from the night bellhop. Even before I became an alcoholic, I had the professional alcoholic's cunning instinct for knowing when, where, and how to get a needed bottle or so when the bars and package stores were closed. Those 2 bottles, and a good many more, saw me through the days before my wife came home from the hospital, minus her arm. and I visited her every single day, trying to get the precise exact balance into my system so that I'd have enough of the magic fluid inside me to get there, to the hospital, and into Louise's private room. And not too much so that she would notice any effects on me, but I never did get that perfect balance, or enough inside me not to notice that her arm wasn't there anymore. And each time before I left home to go to the hospital, I'd say to myself, "Now this time don't look. Look into her bright, bright eyes, or simply read to her from a book, or look at the floor and count the cracks and wet mop marks, or look at the table, the bedspread, or even the new red scar on her temple, but don't look at her arm." But the moment I entered Louise's room, trying to smile, trying to say something cheerful, and most of the time struggling just to say something, anything, my eyes couldn't keep away from that. I could never stay put for the full 2-hour visiting period without excusing myself and going to the men's room down the hall for a drink. I always stashed a bottle in there before going to my wife's room, just plain old common horse sense, the kind that convinces us that the world is flat. Because I never would have made it otherwise, unless... I think I could have taken it a little better, perhaps, if Louise had only berated me, cursed me. This idea is only supposition, but Louise took it too well, too bravely, like a saint. And she lost so much weight so fast that even she looked like a saint. There was always the touch of pink on her lips, the lipstick a little crooked, awkwardly applied, of course, the pitiful effort to fix herself up for my daily visit, and the too sweet martyr's smile, and the round wet eyes, but without tears. No bitterness, ever. Never a whimper out of her, not a word about its being all my fault. There's a Christian for you. Every damned time. But that's enough about the beginning and all that. But it led to later, much later, some 4 years later, when everything was gone, my business, at least my half of it, I was sold out at less than a tenth of what my half was worth because I had to halve the cash. I was a public accountant, not a CPA, because we were doing all right, Herb and I, counting the increased income tax business and all, and Herb got up the price, and I asked for my half because I had set about it so deliberately and ridiculously low. All was fair, and I have no complaints on that score. I certainly wasn't pulling my share of the load. After the accident, I didn't go to the office more than once or twice a week. And then I didn't go at all, because I couldn't do any work if I did go, and for more than a year before I sold out to Herb, I didn't set foot in the place. I just phoned and asked Herb to call the bank and okay a $10 or $20 check for me when I needed dough. And when Herb came to his senses and refused to okay any more checks for me, I sold out to him, and that money went to... The money all went so fast. The hospital bills, the doctors. I couldn't afford the private room for Louise in the first place, but I couldn't afford not to have it. Or the exorbitant accompanying medical consultations, which were nothing but money thrown down the drain. The savings, the bonds, all went. There were the expensive private rehabilitation lessons for my wife. And then our home went too. The car, of course, was a total loss. I used the insurance money as one of the hospital payments. And Mother died, and I had to pay for her funeral. Although Mother didn't have any money of her own, I inherited her tiny house, naturally, which was fortuitous if it was anything. Louise and I moved into it, and here we are. Louise, with only one arm, was making like a housewife. And I was making like a drunk with both of my arms, and there was no money coming in. Suddenly, just like that, we were on relief, the bounty of the county. But I didn't care, really. Not at first. At least mother never lived to see the day. She would have cared. All at once, we were on the poor and needy rolls of all the weird churches and women's clubs in the city. The Methodists, the Baptists, the Church of God's Flock, the Presbyterians, and naturally the Unitarians took this avid interest in all our affairs. The Unitarians were in on it because of mother, and all of the ministers from these various churches kept coming around to commiserate with my wife. A new one every day, it seemed, and my wife and the visiting minister would be kneeling and praying and talking in undertones by the hour in the living room while I sat in the kitchen trying to drown their funereal voices with a bottle. Très gay it was, but I couldn't say anything about it, one way or the other, because this sort of thing was all the pleasure my wife had left to her. Evidently she couldn't talk to me, and I couldn't talk to her. The social worker's name was Miss Whiteside, Mary Ellen Whiteside. She was about 32, give a few years, and her weekly visits to the house with the weekly check were like clockwork. Miss Whiteside didn't resemble the social worker stereotype, except perhaps for her absurd hats and white gloves, and she drove a Buick, not last year's Ford or Chevy like most of them drive. But she was right there with the $55 check every week, on time and in person. With alcoholics, the social worker is required to bring the weekly check in person instead of mailing them. Only idiots, imbeciles, and morons are entitled to get their relief checks via the mails. Alcoholics can't be trusted, it seems. Miss Whiteside would hand me the check, and after I signed it, she pointedly handed it to my wife, another rule, and then departed in her baby blue Buick. My good wife, who was now walking a little lopsided, despite the expensive rehabilitation lessons, would then trot down to the corner, cash the cheque and bring the money, all of it, back to me. I would give Louise 10 or 15 magnanimous dollars and drink through the rest of it. Oh, my wife never said a word about my drinking, not to me anyway, the martyr bit, don't you know. I think it was Shaw who said something about martyrs, that martyrdom is the way to recognition for the person of no talent or ability. Something like that. The exact quotation doesn't make any difference. If only we had fought or talked things over sensibly, or if she had only screamed her head off at me, piling enough curses on my head to enable me to desert the woman in all good conscience. But no, it was always pretend. Pretend, pretend. Everything is lovely. Of course, her arm was gone, and she had an unsightly 4-inch scar on her forehead, as well as the jagged scar on her temple, and she had dropped from a well-shaped 120 pounds down to a scrawny 86 pounds. The arm hadn't weighed that much. And me, her bluttery husband, I was a drunk. My business was gone, my money was gone, our beautiful home was gone, and we were on relief. Relief? Daily the churches delivered food baskets to our door. We had no children, but that didn't make any difference. We got toys delivered to the house just the same. Ladies' clubs and auxiliaries were driving up in groups and depositing clothes, dresses, suits, shirts, shoes, and all kinds of stuff on our front porch. Last Christmas, for example, we got 6 basketfuls of assorted groceries, 3 turkeys, one of them already cooked and stuffed, and 2 Christmas trees, complete with ornaments, delivered right to the door by those good, God-fearing people. Oh, no. Nothing was wrong. Nothing had happened the way Louise and I acted towards each other, so very polite and all. We accepted all this stuff with mumbled thanks to the donors, as though it were the way people were supposed to live. We didn't sleep together any more. That sort of thing would have been impossible for me, and Louise never mentioned it. So I would drink up the money at Nelson's, the bar nearest to the house, setting them up for the boys when I had the cash, after rat-holing some of my weekly stipend, first for package stuff later in the week. And after the money was gone, I pawned some of the clothing the women's clubs and auxiliaries brought around for the purpose. And so it was, until Fred managed to get through to me and then straightened me out. Fred was an alcoholic, he said, and it was time that I too recognized the fact that I am an alcoholic. Okay, I said, so I'm an alcoholic. So we talk it out, Fred said. And talk it out I did as well as I could, although I had reached the point where I didn't care whether I was an alcoholic or not, or so I thought. I couldn't talk to my disabled wife, and Fred didn't judge me. He was easy to talk to, after I got started. We attended AA meetings together, although I went to these meetings as a favour to Fred at first. Sitting there that way in the rented hall, listening to those people, alcoholics like myself, and hearing some of the terrible stories they told, which were worse than mine. Well, perhaps not. No man has ever had troubles that are greater than another man's, but these stories were all sort of inspiring to me. Comebacks had been made after all, and almost overnight, it seemed, I quit drinking. I didn't taper off, I merely quit, just like that, and just for a day at a time, as Fred had suggested. And it was easy, because I knew it was only for the day, and I could start drinking the next morning if I wanted to. But I didn't. I began to get a few friendly, encouraging visits from other AA members, and they were all decent guys. It took about a month. I was fairly well straightened out, but I was restless. A man has to do something, and I wasn't doing anything because I had lost my full-time job of drinking. I started thinking about a job. Naturally, I didn't go back and see old Herb or try for anything in the accounting line. I wasn't ready yet. Too many people around town knew that I was a drunk, and I wasn't about to put any of my former friends on the spot by forcing them to turn me down for a job. But there was a brand new supermarket that had opened recently, only 6 blocks away from the house, and I applied there for a position, talking frankly to the manager. "I'm an alcoholic," I told him bluntly, "but I've joined AA, and I haven't had a drink now for more than a month. I need a job, and I have to get my self-respect back. I know figures, I'm a competent accountant, and if you'll give me a chance I can mark prices on cans, total inventories for you, and—" "Grab a broom," he said. The manager gave me a chance, and $35 a week. I was issued a black leather bow tie, a clean apron, and a new broom. There were tears of gratitude in my eyes, and I could have kissed his feet then and there. And all week long I've been working, sweeping, dusting, mopping, carrying, and shivering happily in the frigid air conditioning of the new store. Miss Whiteside came round this afternoon, on my first day off, with the weekly relief check. I laughed, with the excitement and all, I had forgotten to telephone her about my new job. "I've got a job, Miss Whiteside," I said proudly. I tore the relief check in half and handed her the pieces. She flushed slightly, started to say something, but my wife caught her eye. The two women went outside and sat, talking, in Miss Whiteside's car for about 20 minutes. Then the social worker drove away for what I thought was the last time. But it was just a few minutes ago, before I started to write this letter, when Miss Whiteside returned, after my wife let her in and retired behind the closed door of her bedroom. Miss Whiteside placed a fifth of whiskey on the kitchen table before me. "Let's talk for a while, George," Miss Whiteside began, favouring me with a friendly smile. "For once in your life I think you should think about somebody else instead of yourself."
"What?"
"Please, let me talk." She placed a white-gloved hand on my arm.
"You, George, are an alcoholic. You know it, and I know it, so why pretend that you aren't?"
"Who's pretending?" I protested.
"You are, George. You won't keep that sweeper's job for 2 weeks, and in your heart you know it. You can't possibly keep away from liquor, George, because you're an alcoholic. Besides, what are they paying you? $35 a week. We're already paying you $55 a week, so what do you think you're gaining by pretending to be something you're not? And if you don't have any feelings left for your poor crippled wife, who will be cut off from every organized charity in town the moment it gets around that you're working again, what about me?"
"You?
Haven't I been decent to you ever since I took your case? Did I ever lecture you, bawl you out for drinking?"
"No," I shook my head.
"Have I ever been late with your check? Have I ever asked for a kickback?"
"No," I replied defensively, "but I'm entitled to some credit myself. I've always been here to sign it when you come, whether I've been drunk or sober."
"Granted. And don't think I haven't appreciated it either, George. But for a moment, just for a moment, I want you to hear my side of the story. Do you know that there are only 32 cases left on the county relief rolls? The truth of the matter is, George, I'm already in trouble. If I don't come up with at least 2 or 3 more active cases by the beginning of the fiscal year, I'm liable to lose my job, or at best be transferred into the city. And I've got my roots here, George. I support my mother, and it isn't easy to find new social worker positions nowadays, not in these prosperous times," she added bitterly. To my astonishment, her lips trembled, but before I could say anything, she went ahead with it. "The truth of the matter is, George, I need you on my rolls, and you and your wife need me. So, for once in your life, show a little selflessness. You want a drink right now, don't you?" She pushed the bottle toward me. "No," I said honestly, "I don't really want to drink, Miss Whiteside. One drink would probably get me started all over again. But I honestly didn't know that the times were so good. I mean, so bad from your point of view."
"It so happens that they are, George," she sighed. The corners of her worried mouth turned up slightly, but it wasn't even a good imitation of a brave smile, and her eyes behind her glasses were much too bright. "I know you won't let me down, George." She touched me lightly, timidly, on the shoulder. "Or your poor wife, either." She turned away and smoothed the skirt wrinkles down over her hips. "I'll leave the bottle," she added without looking back. For a long time after Miss Whiteside left the house, I just sat here at the table, staring bewilderedly at the bottle of whiskey without really seeing it. And then I began to write this long, desperate, yes, what else, meaningless letter. And now that I've finished it, I'm going to open the bottle and have a small drink. And then, perhaps another. Why not? When next Christmas rolls around, maybe we'll get 8 lousy turkeys. Nobody's. I am an alcoholic.